open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning. This is February 20th, 2018. We've got two informational hearings today. The first one about the recent action by the FNW Commission to uplist the marbled murrelet from threatened to endangered. The second's going to be about sea lion predation in the Columbia River. So let's get started with our marbled murrelet hearing. Let me open an informational hearing and ask Doug Cottom, Lena Tucker, and Brian Pugh from ODF&W and ODF to come up and chat with us. Okay, so I don't know who would like to start, but I can tell you that the legislative committee that deals with forestry policy and animal policy was really interested to hear what happened last Friday and would like to hear more about that. I know you probably don't have one of your commissioners at the dais anyway, but I think you may have one in the audience, I'm not sure, and it's possible that we'll have questions that, you know, are more about what's in the mind of the commissioners that you can't answer, but at least tell us what happened. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Cottom. I'm the Wildlife Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I am going to talk about the recent reclassification of marbled murrelets from threatened to endangered under the Oregon Endangered Species Act. Marbled murrelets are small, robin-sized birds, spends most of their lifetime in the marine environment, in the near shore, eating small forage fish. But they kind of lead a double life, where they actually fly up to 50 miles inland to nest in late successional trees. They lay a single egg on a large branch or a deformed branch high in the canopy. Back in 1992, the birds were listed as federally threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act in the states of Washington, Oregon, and California. And then they were listed by the state in 1995 as threatened. The primary reason for both of these listings was the loss of nesting habitat. Much of the historic nesting habitat for marbled murrelets was removed by 1992, and most of the remaining habitat now persists on public lands. In this illustration, the lighter and the darker blue are the concentration areas of the late successional forest where they do nest. The primary state landowning and managing agencies with most murrelet habitat right now include the Department of Forestry, the Department of State Lands, and the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. A little bit of information on why did the commission consider reclassifying the birds. Back in June of 2016, we received a petition from a group of conservation organizations, Cascadia Wildlands, Center for Biological Diversity, the Coast Range Forest Watch, Oregon Wild, the Audubon Society of Portland, and the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. The petitioners recommended that the murrelet be reclassified from threatened to endangered under the Oregon ESA. After review of the petition, the commission decided to accept the petition based on it had sufficient scientific evidence in it. That occurred back in September of 2016. That decision started a rulemaking process, which included consultation with interested and affected parties. That's including state agencies, state and local governments, tribes, interested parties, conservation organizations, that sorts of thing. We also began a biological status review of the species in Oregon, which is basically a technical report on their life history, the biology, what their population's doing. And we also had that status review reviewed by a peer group that was also designed to provide some more information for the commission. I want to make it clear that the Oregon Endangered Species Act does require the commission to base any reclassification decisions on documented and verifiable scientific information. Back in the February of 2017, we sent out the request for scientific information. We did receive a lot of technical reports and a lot of data from different sources. With that information, we prepared an initial draft release for public comment back in September of 2017 and for peer review. All the comments that we received, we considered in developing a final document, which we just released back in early January this year. Just a little clarification on the difference between threatened and endangered species under Oregon's ESA. A threatened species is any native wildlife species that the commission determines is likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future throughout any significant portion of its range. And an endangered species is any wildlife species determined by the commission to be in danger of extinction throughout any significant portion of its range. So there's a two-step process when considering uplisting or reclassifying a species under the Oregon ESA. The first step, which has to occur first, is determining whether uplisting is warranted. And second step is if uplisting is warranted, are there circumstances that apply for which the commission may choose to not uplist? I'll talk about this in a little more detail in these next two slides. So there's two questions to be answered to determine whether or not uplisting is warranted. The first one is, based on documented and verifiable scientific information, has the likelihood of survival of the species diminished such that the species is in danger of extinction throughout any significant portion of its range in the state? And the second question is, does at least one of the following three factors exist? Those factors are: most populations are undergoing imminent or active deterioration of their range, are they being overutilized, and three, existing state or federal programs or regulations are inadequate to protect the species or its habitat. Once they've decided whether to uplist or not, and if they decide to uplist, the commission then may decide, under certain circumstances, not to list wildlife species as endangered that would otherwise qualify to be so based on these three factors. Is the future of the species secure outside the state? Is it true that the species is not of cultural, scientific, or commercial significance to the state? Or has the species been listed as threatened or endangered pursuant to the Federal Endangered Species Act? And like I said earlier, they are listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act. So the commission is required to evaluate whether or not that listing provides adequate protection for the bird. A little bit more information on our peer review process. We had four subject matter experts review our initial draft, and we had them review to look to make sure that we included the best available science and whether or not we accurately and objectively portrayed that information in the report. We also had a lot of public comment. We had thousands of emails in particular. I might mention that many of those emails were of the form letter variety, most of which were asking us to just uplist the bird without a lot of reasons for that. But we also received comments from state agencies, industry, scientific and research institutions, local governments, conservation organizations, and the public. So the commission determined that uplisting was warranted, which meant that they had directed the staff to begin develop survival guidelines for adoption at the time of reclassification in this coming June. The reason why they made this decision, there were some key factors that they had to consider. The first is the habitat requirements and the life history of these birds. As I mentioned earlier, they're pretty unique. They have very low reproductive success. They only lay one egg. They don't necessarily breed every year. And those birds that do nest, they only have about a 36% chance of being successful in nesting. because they're so hard to find when they're on land in the nests or in these old forest trees, population estimates are conducted by at-sea surveys. Those surveys began back in 1992. By 1996, it was determined that there was a significant decline in the murrelet population, greater than 50%. Beginning in the year 2000, however, the Northwest Forest Plan began monitoring the birds at sea. And since 2000 through 2015, the population has been stable. It might even have a slightly upward trend in the population. Just so you know, in 2015, the estimated population was approximately 11,000 birds throughout the state of Oregon, plus or minus 3,000. In 2017, Oregon State University began a research project on marble murrelets. They captured and transmitted approximately 61 birds off the coast of Oregon. During the breeding season last year, 30% of those birds took off and flew down to California. None of the birds nested last year. I'm not sure that any even tried to nest, but they were all unsuccessful. That kind of movement puts some uncertainty into these at-sea surveys that are conducted, just because when we see these birds moving to other states, it definitely confounds some of the data. Back in 2004, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was conducting a status assessment of the birds, and they had some extinction probability models created for that assessment. Those models have predicted that there's an 80% extinction probability by the year 2060 for murrelets in southern Oregon, and greater than an 80% extinction probability for the entire state of Oregon by the end of this century. There's also been changes in habitat analyzed in the Northwest Forest Plan. Since 1992, there has been a loss of approximately 79,000 acres of suitable habitat for nesting. Most of that is on non-federal lands. That doesn't mean that there weren't acres gained. However, the amount of acres lost exceeded the habitat that was gained by about 79,000 acres. And, you know, there is mounting evidence of climate change affecting Pacific Northwest ecosystems. It's expected that in the coast forest, warmer and drier climates could easily result in more wildfires, disease outbreaks. The climate change is also affecting our marine conditions. From the years 2013 through 2016, if you remember the warm water blob that came down from the North Pacific and sat off the Oregon coast, combined with El Nino effects, the water temperature warmed, caused a change in the abundance and the species of forage fish that many seabirds feed on, and many seabirds suffered starvation and nesting failures from California to Alaska. So these are the main key factors why the decision was made to uplist birds. So what are the implications of uplisting? The Oregon Endangered Species Act only applies to state-owned lands. It does not directly apply to private lands. The Oregon Endangered Species Act requires the state landowning and state land managing agencies to develop endangered species management plans and to comply with commission-adopted survival guidelines. Survival guidelines are more or less quantifiable and measurable guidelines that are necessary to ensure the survival of individual members of the species, not the species in whole, but actual individual members. So that's something like take avoidance guidelines or protecting critical resource sites, like protecting the nest sites themselves. The biological status review, the uplisting reclassification process, did not examine economic implications of the uplisting. However, now economic considerations do enter into developing and future implementation of the survival guidelines and approval of the endangered species management plans. According to the Oregon Endangered Species Act, The legal process now is more or less set. In March, right here, right away, really, we will begin developing survival guidelines in coordination with the state agencies that are affected. And we will also be considering all of the federal consultations that these agencies have already been doing over the years. By June of 2018, we will do our rulemaking to reclassify the species and adopt survival guidelines. 18 months after that, by December of 2019, the affected state agencies are required to have developed and adopted endangered species management plans. And within 6 months after that, the Fish and Wildlife Commission will have reviewed those and adopted them as well. And for the moment, I'd like to turn it over to the Department of Forestry. It's okay.
We'll do questions at the end.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Pugh. I serve as the Deputy Chief of our State Forest Division at the Oregon Department of Forestry. The Oregon Department of Forestry appreciates this opportunity to provide informational testimony on the recent uplisting of the Marble Murrelet from threatened to endangered under the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission's Endangered Species Act. This testimony will cover information from the State Forest Division, as well as information from the Board of Forestry rulemaking process related to the Private Forest Division. Lena Tuckle will cover that next. The Board of Forestry lands managed by the State Forest Division is overall 97% of what we manage. So Board of Forestry lands are managed for a greatest permanent value, and that greatest permanent value mandate is a range of social, economic, and environmental benefits. The other 3% of the land that the division manages is common school forest lands. The common school forest land mandate is to obtain the greatest benefit for the people of the state consistent with sound management practices. Overall, the division manages 3% of the forest lands in Oregon. So we are a very minority land manager, so at just 3%. The State Forest Division manages about 560,000 acres of forest lands within the range of the Marble Murrelet, and that's spread across 12 counties. The majority of the lands we manage are on the North Coast, and Clatsop, and Tillamook counties that are the Murrelet habitat areas. The State Forest is operated under the Forest Management Plan that is approved by our Board of Forestry. And the current Forest Management Plan addresses habitat protection and creation for a number of species, including the Marble Murrelet. In addition, State Forest has an existing program specific to the Murrelet. This program includes surveying suitable habitat to determine if they're occupied habitat or not, establishing protections around occupied sites, evaluating and minimizing the effects of timber sales on occupied sites, and ongoing consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that we are in compliance with the Federal Endangered Species Act. State Forest has a strong program in place working with the Federal Endangered Species Act, built on an extensive survey program and a case-by-case consultation with that federal service. So the effects of the uplifting under the Oregon Endangered Species Act could range from no effect if existing ODF policies and forest management plans are adequate for the survival guidelines and for the Endangered Species Management Plan, to moderate or major effects if these guidelines and plans expand requirements that are already in place. ODF&W staff implements the direction from the Commission. State Forest will work to ensure full understanding of our forest management plan and current policies protecting the Murrelet. It's going to be important as we move forward in this manner to address the direction of the legislature as outlined by the applicable statutes and the policy direction of both the Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Board of Forestry. So we will continue to work closely with ODF&W. I did testify about a week and a half ago at the commission meeting with our weed biologist, and the staff from both agencies continue to work together as we understand more about what this means. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lena Tucker.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lena Tucker. I serve as the Private Forest Division Chief with the Oregon Department of Forestry. The Private Forest Division promotes sound management of private forests while maintaining high water resource quality, soil productivity, and fish and wildlife habitat. The Department of Forestry Stewardship Foresters work with private landowners to educate and enforce the Oregon Forest Practices Act. The Forest Practices Act encourages private forest land investment that is guided by a consistent regulatory environment. The FPA underpins a social contract between landowners and the public, assuring responsibly managed forest. The Board of Forestry is responsible for carrying out the purpose of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Rules created by the board should be consistent with their policy to ensure the continuous growing and harvesting of forestry species. Rules shall provide for the overall maintenance of the following resources: air quality, water resources, soil productivity, and fish and wildlife habitat. In regards to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife uplisting of the marbled murrelet, there is no direct effect to private landowners as a result of the uplisting. It's also important to note that the Forest Practices Act is not a compliance tool for the Federal Endangered Species Act. The board and the department are actively engaged in an analysis to consider rules under the FPA for the marbled murrelet. The board's process for adopting rules includes an evaluation of the best available information, which demonstrates how resource sites are sensitive to forest practices. The board must identify these resource sites used by a species and identify those forest practices that conflict with the resource site. They can propose protection requirements and exceptions for those resource sites. At the direction of the board, the department staff are developing a technical report for the marbled murrelet as part of the rule analysis process. This draft technical report contains a summary of the ecology and habitat used by the murrelets. It's similar to the one that Fish and Wildlife developed. In this report, identification of resource sites for marbled murrelets. We have to identify forest practices that may pose a conflict for the species and discuss the consequences of those conflicts. Information on options for protection of the species is also provided as per administrative rules. The board will review an economic analysis in conjunction with proposed rule language, but we're quite a ways away from that process right now. At this time, we're anticipating an 18 to 24 month process with the rulemaking analysis, and the outcome is not known at this time. However, possible outcomes include no changes to the Forest Practices Act, use of non-regulatory actions, incentive programs such as safe harbor agreements and stewardship agreements, regulatory actions, or a combination of both. And with that, thank you again for your time here today.
Okay, so we've got some time for questions. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank all of you for the time, and particularly the commission, for having wrestled with this issue. I know it can't be an easy one, and I'm sure there, no matter what the decision is, there's going to be a great deal of the public that would be unhappy with whatever decision comes down. But as a legislator, I don't have the benefit of having immersed myself in studying this issue, but I did notice in your presentation that one of the criteria for uplisting was, quote-unquote, the likelihood of survival of the species has diminished. And I'd like to focus on two words here, likelihood and diminished, in terms of common parlance. Likelihood of the survival of the species. Now, with an 80% plus extinction probability, I would have to assume that the survival of that species is not great. I mean, by your own figures, it's 80%. I almost think it's a conclusion that this species is going to go extinct. So if there is that likelihood of extinction, and the word diminished would suggest that at some point that survival was greater, that it is somehow diminished, how do you get any worse than an 80% extinction probability? How did this species that lays one egg, and that egg has a 36% chance of success by your own statistics, how does the probability diminish from 80%? I don't understand how we meet the basic criteria to uplist when in fact it appears that no matter what we do, this species is on its way to extinction.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, great question. Very difficult. I might point out that those extinction probability models are models, and they were created back in 2004. And at that time, which, hadn't had a lot of time since the Federal Endangered Species Act was enacted, that there has been a significant reduction in the loss of habitat, especially on federal lands. And there is a lot of uncertainty with models in themselves. And so one of the reasons why this was a difficult decision for the commission is exactly what you brought up. The fact is they also have significant conditions in the marine environment that they have to deal with, in particular loss of their typical forage fish. So I don't necessarily think that it's a guarantee that they have an 80% extinction probability as the state and the federal government adapts to what their survival needs really are. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but I am not that pessimistic that they will go extinct, considering the actions that have happened since those models were created. However, when you have significant climate change issues that we are seeing now, species that are highly specialized like this, one that nests on land and lives in the ocean, those are the types of wildlife species that are most threatened by changing climate.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, thank you for that answer. And not to press the point, but I was watching that presentation, and I think what triggered this whole review was a request by a number of groups to take a look at the situation. And I have to wonder, based on the litigation record by a number of those groups, whether a letter from them just means that the state has caved and we don't want litigation, so we're going to investigate this and we're going to uplist this bird. But I'll tell you, I would hate to be in your position to try and defend with the statistics that you've just given me. I mean, I think the ground is very ripe for a suit by folks on the other side that the very criteria don't support an uplisting. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity.
So before we go to Rep. McCune, I have one quick question. You said it was a 2004 model, but is it run all the time, or is the data actually 2004?
The data is actually 2004. So that was information from 2004.
And then the other study you referenced was from 2005 to 2015.
The Chair Clem, the
at-sea
monitoring, at-sea population estimates was
2000 to 2015.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Representative McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And I echo what Representative Witt said. This is a very gnarly, difficult issue. And I do appreciate the good work that's gone into it and the position that you all find yourselves in. I guess one of the things that caught my attention when you were giving your testimony, and I thank you for your testimony, is the lack of consideration of economic impact of the uplisting. Of course, for me, the Elliott looms large. What my people care about that I hear from my constituents is they want access to the Elliott. That's very important to them, whether it's for hunting, fishing, gathering, recreation, whatever it is. They also are very interested in setting aside pieces of the Elliott for carbon sequestration and for habitat and for old growth. It's a very important piece. But there's a balance in there between those two things and harvest, which is creating that economic opportunity for people down on the South Coast. And when the land board ruled, they put together a plan that called out a certain level of harvest in that plan to make sure that there was still a modicum of economic vitality and money going into the Common School Fund. So I guess my question to you is, and I was trying to look up the numbers really quick. I know we used to harvest about 50 million board feet a year. I think her proposal was down to about 20% of that. And those numbers may be way off, but it's diminished. But there was a target there. What does this uplisting do to that target harvest for the Elliott, and how will that economically impact the South Coast?
Chair Clem, Representative McCune, I think the Department of Forestry may want have a better idea about that than I do. Not to put you on the spot, sorry.
No, that's why we're here together. Chair Clem, if I may, Representative McCune, I understand the questions around the Elliott State Forest there, and to be on the record, a couple of things first before I get to your answer, if you may. The Department of Forestry ended the management of the Elliott State Forest last July 1st. So in July of 2017, the Department of State Lands took the management of the Elliott State Forest back. And so in my testimony today, it was specific to the Board of Forestry lands and then the Common School lands outside of the Elliott. So I'm not in a position where I can speak to the Elliott. That question would have to go to the Department of State Lands. But I am in a position to answer a similar question for the North Coast, if you would, because that's the Board of Forestry lands. And really what I was, and I appreciate the follow-up question, because I was trying to make the point in my testimony that we take into consideration the Murrelet now in our forest management plans and provide protections that meet the Endangered Species Act under the Federal Endangered Species Act. There is potential to have a significant impact by this uplifting by the commission, but we don't know what that impact will be economically, conservation, or other benefits till we get into those survival guidelines, and then real specifically till we get to the Endangered Species Management Plan, which will be due in about 18 months according to Doug's timeline. And so we are definitely in a kind of a wait and see of what that answer is, and feel strongly that we have good management of Oregon State Forest and provide for a range of benefits across a range of species. And so we are going to work closely on this issue to try to maintain what we currently do.
Just a very quick follow-up.
Can we, Representative Brock-Smith, we got four in line right now.
Got it.
Rep. Brock-Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having this informational hearing. And I appreciate your questions as well, because that was one of mine. So just two quick questions. Where's the marble murrelets territory along the United States?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock-Smith, they range from Northern California all the way to Alaska.
So what's the total population of the marble murrelet population in the United States?
Representative Brock-Smith, I don't know the answer to that question.
That's interesting. With the data that we're uplisting, we don't have that information. And then secondly, you mentioned in your testimony with the 2000 and 2015 data, which I find ironic that we're going after a tooth, we're using in an uplisting a 2004 model with 2004 data for extinction when making an uplisting decision, yet we have 2000 and 2015 data with your own testimony, sir, that says that the murrelet is stable and possibly increasing, yet we're uplisting above and beyond the federal level of just threatened. Can you tell me how and why we're using old data to uplist species that could have a huge economic impact along the coast, and where the emails from the environmental groups and organizations outweigh that of the legislative body that sent you an email, a letter opposing this very uplisting?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, all of the information that we provided was all of the documented scientific evidence that we could gather. Back in 2004, when the survival or the extinction probability models were made, that was not very many years after the at-sea surveys detected a greater than 50% decline in the murrelet population, which those at-sea surveys began in 1992. So the current level of the population is very much lower than it was historically. But yes, it has stabilized around 11,000 birds since the year 2000. So although the population has stabilized, it is very much lower than what it was historically.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, you were saying there was about 13,000 of these in the Oregon coast. Does that include the 30% that goes to California, or minus that?
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, that's a great question. The 2015 surveys was population estimate was around 11,000 plus or minus 3,000. However, the OSU research that was conducted does bring doubt into those at-sea surveys because of this movement of the birds that they detected going down to California. So there's the likelihood that birds from Oregon go to Washington as well, and Washington birds may come down to Oregon. So it puts some uncertainty into those at-sea surveys.
So conclusion is we really don't know?
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, there's a lot of uncertainty in these estimates, yes.
One last question.
Follow-up. Yep.
You were saying that the breeding stock that you captured and tagged didn't breed, okay, but did anyone take into account of shock from being captured? Because I know that there are certain species that if you capture them and tag them, they will not breed for at least a year.
Representative Esquivel, I believe that OSU spends a lot of time researching in the proper way to tag and locate and handle those animals. That's always a question as to whether or not that had some sort of effect in their breeding success. I do know that OSU suspects that it was ocean conditions that resulted in those birds flying down to California instead of breeding here off the coast of Oregon.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple questions. One, I may have missed this, but who are their natural enemies? And then also, specifically, you mentioned climate change affects them, and so specifically, how does that climate change affect their habitat or their food?
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, start with your last question first. The climate change has resulted in warmer water conditions, in particular in the marine environment. We saw, I shouldn't say we, but it was determined that the forage fish species that they normally feed on had moved to other waters. The forage fish that they were feeding on were not of the same quality, and therefore it affects breeding success. I mean, the marble murrelet depends on cold water and a good food supply to successfully breed. Excuse me, sir, what was your first question?
The first question, natural enemies.
Another great question. So the 36% survival rate for successful nesting is primarily due to predation, and that is predation by ravens, crows, and jays, and other species, bird species like that.
Thank you. Can I have one?
Sure, then I've got some.
So when they land on the water, are there any enemies they have in the water that come up and eat them, like sea lions or anything?
Representative, that is, if it happens, it's a minor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so Yeah, my questions are really, I would say, oversight questions about whether the commission followed the statute, because that's what's important here. The Legislative Assembly makes statutes for a reason, and they need to be followed exactly. So in the statute, it says the commission shall determine one or the more following factors exist. You had it on your slide, A, B, C. So which one of those did they determine existed? Is it one or more? So.
Yes. So,
which one or more?
Okay, I just got to that slide. So,
A is the
question. A was most populations are undergoing imminent or active deterioration of their range or primary habitat. I think the answer to that is yes.
What is it?
Because they have lost approximately 79,000 acres of suitable nesting habitat since 1992.
So A is the one that I want to, don't want to know speculation. What did the commission identify as their statutory criteria? A, B, and C. A, not B, C. A and B, not C.
Okay.
Yeah.
A would be yes. Overutilization of the habitat would be yes. Existing state federal programs is also yes.
Meaning existing regulation, the existing state or federal programs or regulations are inadequate to protect the species. So the Federal Endangered Species Act is inadequate to protect the species?
Yes.
The Act, not its status. The Act itself is inadequate to protect the species. Meaning if the feds uplisted, they still wouldn't be protected unless Oregon acted. That's what Legislative Council is going to come back and tell me that means.
Chair Clem, as far as the Act...
Yeah,
the, I would agree that the answer to that is no.
Correct. Yeah, I think you're right. B, the overutilization for commercial, recreational, scientific, or educational purposes is occurring. And this is the overutilization of the species, I assume.
Or its habitat.
It doesn't say habitat. It says that overutilization. So what's being overutilized and for what?
If it does not have the word habitat in there.
Yeah, I'm reading it. It doesn't.
Okay.
Unless the letter I have is different than what you've got on your slide.
My slide says it were its habitat, sir. I'm sorry.
Now, it could be this. Mine's not right, although I had it online. Okay, so let's talk habitat then. The overutilization of its habitat, which is, in this case, what?
Chair Logging, Clem, that is ATVs. The suitable nesting habitat.
So what's the overutilization the commission found? Is it?
Harvest. Of timber.
Okay, and I mean, we're going to get into at some point a discussion about how much timber is being harvested relative to 1990-ish, whatever you said, levels, because I know it's a lot less. A lot less timber is being harvested overall. I can tell you my hometown has no mills anymore because of it. Okay, let's go to A. Most are undergoing imminent or active deterioration of their range. So that's about the acres, not necessarily about the bird numbers.
Of the range and their primary habitat.
So the bird numbers can be irrelevant in this question, meaning even if we should go on 2015 data and the bird numbers are stable, if the habitat's going down but the bird numbers are stable, A could trigger.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Might be a flaw in the statute. That's our problem, not your commission's problem. Because if the habitat changes but the bird numbers don't go down, they're not really moving towards endangerment at that point. There is a assumption built in the statute that the habitat drives the bird numbers. And if we find scientifically that's not occurring, then that's a problem with the actual statute.
Chair Clem.
Representative Brock Smith.
Well, no, just a question to you. And I'll pull up the slide, but ORS 196 or 496 clearly states in item B that overutilization for commercial, recreational, scientific, or educational purposes is occurring or is likely to occur. It does not say habitat.
Yeah, we'd have to figure out what that's supposedly referencing, because the word before it in A is habitat, but I'm not sure if B is supposed to be referring to habitat in A or what B is referring to. We can figure that out later. I think A is the one that I think commission is hinging on, though then you have to go to Representative Witt's question in the rules and say that, is it going to happen anyway? because even if A is happening, the commission must find the likelihood of survival has diminished such that the species is in danger of extinction throughout any significant portion of its range within the state. So that means it's, you can stop this if you do something. Again, 2004 data, 14-year-old data, is pretty flimsy. So 2015 data sounds a lot better. 2004 doesn't sound so reasonable to be making big decisions on. So what was the vote from the commission? How many in favor, how many opposed?
Chair Clem, the ultimate vote was 4-2 in favor of uplisting.
What's the total number of the commission?
The commission is made up of 7 members. However, there were only 6 present for the commission.
The one was absent. So 4 voted in favor, 2 opposed, 1 absent. Okay. Representative Brock-Smith.
Wasn't there a 3-3 vote initially, and then the commission went back to debate 20 minutes and then came out with 4-2?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock-Smith, you are correct.
Went back where to vote? What do you mean went back?
The commission was split 3-3 and then decided to go back and debate again.
Publicly. Oh, okay. That's what I was trying to get.
Came out and for the
so kept going tied, kept going, and then one person said, "Okay, I'm going for it." I got it. Okay. Further questions, then we'll talk sea lions.
Well,
okay.
I would just like to point out. Thank you. And I appreciate the time because this is a very critical decision that has been made. I would just suggest that whenever you're putting these PowerPoints together and presenting to the legislative body, that on your page, it does at least one of the following 3 factors exist. You have, or its habitat, presented to this body, and it's clearly not in the ORS. And so you shouldn't be adding words that are not in statute. Thank you.
Okay, I don't think we're done with this topic yet, but we are for today. The question about acres lost versus bird numbers, I think, is pretty critical because there's a big assumption built into, it looks like, what the commission has to look at, which is habitat undergoing imminent or active deterioration? If you're saying it's down 79,000 acres, I want to know, like, over what period of time? Because imminent and active means, like, in the last few years. And our harvest levels have changed massively since 1990 till now. And now that the Elliott has already been taken off the table in certain parts of it under this new state proposed plan to have half of it go one way and half of it go the other, was that factored in or things that I'll still want to look at? So for now, we've got a bunch of sea lion folks here. So I thank you for coming, but we'll be back on this topic, I suspect. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank the panel. I know that this
tough job,
probably
yeah.
wasn't an easy encounter, and we very, very much appreciate the work that all of you do on behalf of our state, and certainly appreciate your appearance, so thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. That's a good way to finish. Okay, let me open our informational hearing on sea lion predation. Some folks will have to go to caucus if they want to in 10 minutes. I'm going to stay and listen to this for a while, but if people leave, it's not that they're not going to see sea lions. So Robin Brown, Bruce Pauley. Okay, tell us who's hungry out there.
I'll try to do this quickly and give you some information to ponder, probably for the most part. Chair Clem, representatives of the committee. My name is Robin Brown. I'm program leader for marine mammal research and recently a little management of marine mammals in the state of Oregon. I wanted to give you a quick update about sea lions in the Columbia River. I could basically say there are too many. We have problems with them. They're federally protected. They're eating federally listed threatened and endangered salmonids. We're using every tool that is currently available to us under the federal law, and we're working with our Northwest Congressional delegation to try to amend the law to give us a few more tools. So that's the real snapshot of it. We work Well, with a number of partners, but I'll just mention real quickly, the National Marine Fisheries Service provides probably the lion's share of our funding. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is our direct and important partner on this work. And Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission funnels a lot of the federal dollars to both states. We're talking about seals and sea lions. The little guys at the bottom there are harbor seals, the most common in the state, a seal in the state and in the lower river. They number about 1 to 2 to 6,000, depending on the time of the year in the river. They breed in Oregon, again, federally protected. The larger light-colored animal, the Steller sea lion, they also breed in Oregon, also federally protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I failed to mention harbor seal population has been stable for quite a long time, about 25,000 on the Oregon-Washington coast. Steller sea lions, the group, the eastern stock that occurs here is about 60, 65,000 animals, and it's growing. Has been growing at about 3 to 5% for the past 30 years. And I think I did say they do breed in Oregon and Washington. And then the smaller black sea lion in the upper left is California sea lion. They breed in Southern California. They're seasonal visitors to the Northwest. Their population currently is at about 265,000 animals, and it's actually declining a little bit. And we heard about warm water conditions over the past 4 or 5 years affecting wildlife, and it definitely affected California sea lion survival of the young of the year. So their population is dropping a little bit right now. We might see tens to hundreds Steller sea lions in the Columbia River, and we might see thousands to several thousands California sea lions in the Columbia River. To jump right to California sea lions, because that's the one that we're spent most of our effort looking at and trying to deal with. This is the East Mooring Basin in Astoria. It's the primary area where California sea lions come out of the water to rest in the lower Columbia River. The line squigglies across the bottom from about 1998, when California sea lions really started showing up in the river, through 2017. And if you look at it a little more closely, which we won't, there's a spring peak, a fall peak in numbers as the sea lions move north from the breeding area, and then a spring peak when the sea lions are moving south past the Columbia River to the breeding areas in California again. For many, many years, those numbers were 200-300 in the fall and 300-400 in the spring. Starting in 2013, those numbers, spring and fall, increased quite a bit. You can see there all the way up to 2016, where we actually had a count of nearly 5,000 California sea lions hauled out in the East Mooring Basin at Astoria. Now, the big influx of animals into this area is probably related to the water, poor ocean conditions off California and parts of Oregon that started in about the 2012-2013. Again, just like for the murrelet, the forage fishes that the sea lions rely on and would prefer were not there. The animals move farther north to find colder waters and more prey, and while they're up here, they enter the Columbia River. Another reason for that increase in 13, 14, 15 was a return of large numbers of Columbia River smelt to the lower Columbia River, and smelt are a highly preferred prey for sea lions. Of course, a major concern with these predators in the river, since we've been studying them in the and started marking them in Astoria there in the mid-90s, is that their potential impact on fishery resources of the river, and primarily those would be threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead. There are 13 ESA-listed runs in the main stem Columbia River, and 2 in the Willamette. The upper Willamette winter steelhead are threatened, and the upper Willamette River spring chinook are threatened. Bonneville Dam, 146 miles from the ocean. We started working there in the early 2000s. The Army Corps of Engineer Fish Field Unit started observing sea lion predation and recording animal numbers and fish loss there in 2002, and they continue that through today. We started trapping there in 2007, and started removing, lethally removing known individual predators there in 2008 under an authority that we applied for and received from the National Marine Fisheries Service under the federal law that allows us to remove individually known habitual predators that are impacting threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead. Daytime, they rarely use the traps. Nighttime, the traps are full. In 2016, we had average nightly captures of 12 Stellar sea lions, 24 California sea lions in all of those three traps. And we work from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. doing this work because that's when the animals are there. But of all those animals, only four were on the approved removal list on a typical day. So there's a process, and I can go into more detail later. There's a process for getting these animals on an approved removal list, and then you have to capture them again to get a hold of them. So it's a kind of a frustrating process when you're trying to limit predation on fish to take so few out on any particular day and let so many more go. So from 2008 to 2017, we've lower right-hand corner removed a total of 190, and that's actually 191 now in that we were able to remove a predator, a Bonneville sea lion predator that was caught on a trap at Willamette Falls last week. 15 of the animals went to captivity, 7 of them were died incidental to handling, and 169 now have been chemically euthanized. With work by our veterinarians. Willamette Falls in the early 90s, very few California sea lions. But in the early 2000s, the numbers started going up. And they've gone up through the 2000s, and in 2010, 11, 12, and 13 in that area, the agency tested non-lethal hazing methods to try to keep these animals away from the fishway entrances and away from the falls to very little effect. Non-lethal hazing is temporarily effective, but then does not work, basically, as soon as you're gone. We have placed traps in this area now, which is where we caught the one last week that was on the Bonneville list. And we have applied for a second Section 120 Marine Mammal Protection Act lethal removal authority to be able to take individual predators at this location as well. And that application was submitted 6 months ago or so. It takes about 18 months to go through the federal process to get the approval, so it would be potentially available for the 2019 field season. We initiated monitoring at this site in 2014 and continue through this year to try to get a good idea of the numbers of sea lions and the numbers of fish lost. California sea lion numbers range generally from 1 to 10 a day, August through March, and increase to about 20 to 40 a day, April and May. The numbers and residency time at Willamette Falls has been increasing each year. The diet for California sea lions has been 85% salmonids, 14% lamprey, and a few other fish. Stellar sea lions are also now showing up in the area, and their numbers are ranging from about 1 to 8 different individual animals per day. And right now, they're eating almost exclusively white sturgeon, which is what they did at Bonneville Dam for a number of years until the sturgeon in the area abundance declined so much, and then they started eating salmon and steelhead as well. Let's look at the very right-hand side of this, the potential for escapement above the falls taken by California sea lions in 2014, 15, 16, 17. The top line is winter steelhead, and that's probably the most important one. If you looked at the boxes on the far right, the Chinook and the summer steelhead losses were in the range of 5 to 10% of the total passage over the falls to California sea lions. But the winter steelhead losses ranged from 10 to 15% of the total run up until 2017 when it jumped to 25% of the total run. And that high percentage loss there was the real reason why we applied for another lethal removal authority here. Now, this is another one of those models of probability of extirpation or extinction. I'm not highly familiar with this work. I didn't do it. It's technical. Involves a lot of information. Excuse me. But the take-home message is that without sea lions feeding in the area, the likelihood of the four populations that make up the wild winter stocks, setting aside the Kalapuya, which is not doing very well at all, and probably the influence of sea lions is negligible at this point, but the likelihood of mortality or extinction within a 100-year period for the two Santiam populations and the Malala population without sea lions is less 5% or less. But as soon as you add sea lions into it, and it'll just go straight to the bottom because we're in a hurry, at the highest predation rates observed in 2017, the Malala and the two Santiam populations are exposed to a possibility of extinction over a 100-year period ranging from 21 to 64% likelihood. So the sea lions foraging on these wild winter steelhead potentially have a very, very serious effect on the survivability of the wild winter steelhead passing Willamette Falls. And in conclusion, as I mentioned to begin with, we have a serious problem. We're working under a very restrictive federal law. We're using all the tools that are currently available to us, and we're working with our congressional delegation to see if we can't get the law modified to provide more options for management in these types of resource conflicts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Clem and remaining representative of the commission. My name is Bruce Pauley. I'm an unpaid volunteer with CCA Oregon, Coastal Conservation Association. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed in 1972 with the main objective was to protect whales and to keep dolphins from being caught in tuna fishing nets. But sea lions were covered by these protections as well. At that time, there were about 100,000 California sea lions on the West Coast, and now they're well over 300,000 by some estimates. I have fished the Oregon City area for over 30 years. I have friends who have fished it and lived on it for 60 years, and they never saw a sea lion until 2002. Many local anglers and fishing guides have stopped fishing the Oregon City area because their chances of actually landing a salmon before a sea lion grabs it are very slight. So a world-class fishery right here in the city of Portland has been largely abandoned due to sea lions. In 2002, the wild winter steelhead returns were over 16,000 fish. So these are ESA, endangered species list, wild winter steelhead. The ODFW was considering downlisting the wild winter steelhead at that point because their population was doing so well. And that coincides with about the beginning of the showing up of sea lions at the Oregon City Falls. Nobody, sport or commercial, retains these wild winter steelhead. If they are caught by hook and line, they have to be returned to the water immediately. So since 2002, sea lions have come earlier and stayed later at the falls. Now we have about a dozen year-round residents living at Willamette Falls. Scores more come in seasonally, and they feed on whatever they can find, lamprey, steelhead, salmon, sturgeon. As you may be aware, sturgeon are in trouble with diminishing populations in the Willamette and the Columbia Rivers. Managers agree that sea lions preying on breeding sturgeon are the main culprit. Sturgeon need large rocks and heavy current to spawn successfully, like the area just below Willamette Falls. That is why sport fishers set aside a spawning sanctuary there, just below the falls, where even catch and release fishing for sturgeon is no longer allowed. Now the sanctuary has become a feeding ground where sea lions eat 80-year-old spawning sturgeon. In the last 2 years, sea lions have followed steelhead way up the Sandy River and Clackamas Rivers. These smaller tributary streams are where steelhead spawn. Sea lions miles up these rivers are now eating steelhead right off of their spawning gravel. Last spring, ODFW released a report that said there was a 90% chance of extinction of Willamette winter steelhead if nothing is done about sea lions at Willamette Falls. We are seeing historically low numbers of returning steelhead at a time when sea lions at the falls are at a historic high. This will not last. We testified before this committee in 2011, asking for funding for increased sea lion hazing by ODFW. That was granted. But it had the same effect as it did at Ballard Locks near Seattle. None. Relocation and hazing are documented to not work on sea lions. 3 years ago, CCA organized a sea lion town hall on the banks of the Willamette River. The purpose was to support federal legislation to modify the Marine Mammal Protection Act and raise awareness about sea lion problem. The meeting was attended by Congressman Schrader, Director of ODFW, Robin Brown, from ODFW, and many Oregon legislatures and even county and local elected officials. It was also attended by about 40 members of the Columbia River Treaty Tribes. Some of their elders spoke to the crowd. They explained that passing the MMPA changed the balance between man and the environment, that man had historically been a predator of sea lions but no longer could be, that the fish that they rely on are being threatened, and that this mistake needed to be fixed. Congressman Jamie Herrera Butler from Washington and Congressman Kurt Schrader from Oregon have again sponsored federal legislation that would modify the Marine Mammal Protection Act and allow states and tribes to create safe areas for salmon and other fish to prevent sea lions from preying on endangered and non-endangered fish in these critical areas of the rivers. These areas would be 120 miles up the Columbia River and in all the tributaries that feed into it. The Columbia River Treaty tribes have supported and lobbied in support of this legislation. ODFW and WDFW have supported this legislation. And recently, the governors of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho have voiced their support for this critical legislation. The bill has moved out of the House before, but has never found a path through the U.S. Senate. We have been encouraged by responses to meetings that we have had with the staffs of Senators Merkley and Wyden, but time is running out on these critically endangered fish. We need any help you can provide to encourage our senators to support HB 2083 this year before another Congress is seated and more time is lost. Thank you. I'll be happy to take questions.
Unfortunately, we've got to go to caucus. This is helpful. We'll huddle up as a committee, see what messages we can send to Congress about that bill.
We appreciate that.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I'm going to adjourn our committee. Thank you, Representative White, for sticking around.